This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 9th of May 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Matt Alagaya and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programmes broadcast right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, we'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House, The Monocle Daily and The Ten. Coming up.
What we see in the last few days in accumulated anger, bitterness, malaise within the Ethiopian community or the way they were treated for a long, long time. Many in Israel even dare to doubt their Judaism.
We hear from Yossi Meckelberg in a highlight from The Globalist as we talk about the latest wave of protest in Israel. Plus,
one of the key things that allowed us to move fairly quickly was the fact that we had a sponsor for the project. Having the funds in place to do the project dealt with one of the main hurdles, that is getting funding.
Monocle's very own David Pleasant sits down with architect John McCaslin for one of the episodes of our weekly series. All that and much, much more coming up in the next half hour right here on The Recap with me, Matt Alagaya. You're listening to The Recap with me, Matt Alagaya. Last Sunday, police stormed the streets of Tel Aviv as they tried to contain a protest. Hundreds of the city's Ethiopian Jews were voicing their anger after a video emerged of two Israeli policemen violently beating a soldier of Ethiopian descent. The outpouring of frustration has focused the attention of many in Israel on the issue of race. With so much discursive oxygen taken up by the treatment of the country's Arab population, there are some who argue a more generalized racism has been allowed to go undetected and unchallenged. We asked if they have a point in this highlight of Monday's Monocle Daily, where Dominic Reynolds and Georgina Godwin were joined by Yossi Meckelberg, Associate Fellow in the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House.
This is one of the paradoxes of the Israeli society right now, because in a way Israel is the manifestation of the Zionist dream of bringing as many Jews as possible to the Jewish state. And here in the last 20, 30 years, Israel invested huge resources, actually risking its own security forces in bringing tens of thousands of Ethiopian Jews. But when they arrive, they face actually racism. They come from Ethiopia, probably their skin color is different. And all of a sudden, they face racism by Israelis, the more veterans that they live in Israel. And what we see in the last few days in accumulated anger, bitterness, malaise within the Ethiopian community or the way they were treated for a long, long time. Many of the young that we see in the streets protesting, actually protesting against the humiliation that their parents encounter when they arrive to the country. Many in Israel even dare to challenge or doubt their Judaism, whether Jewish enough. And that's the result of these 20, 30 years.
They are a minority. How small a minority and how integrated are they?
It's a small minority. It's around 140,000 out of a population of 8 million. But they're not integrated, and that's one of the problems. Unfortunately, Israel is a country that has a lot of experience with absorbing immigration, but it doesn't learn from past mistakes. Similar scenes you could see with or approach to immigrants you could see in the 1950s towards Jews from Yemen or from North Africa, as well as Russian that arrived or former Soviet Union that arrived in the 1990s. Every generation discriminates the new generation derived from another country, and there is no lesson learned from past experience. And it's almost the idea that if they are allowed to live in the country, if they are provided with basics, then they can be treated however they are treated.
And that whole idea of the previous generation of immigrants discriminating against the next one is something that sort of happens everywhere, doesn't it? Certainly has done in this city. But I wonder if there's something more specific about a country which, for obvious reasons, focuses so much on its borders and what's beyond those borders and what's inside, that does it mean that it's almost inevitable that this type of tension develops, do you think?
Well, a country that is encountering external threats needs to be even more united than any other countries. It can't even afford the privilege of disunity. And when you get this kind of disunity, bear in mind a lot of these young Ethiopians are Ethiopian, they're Israelis serving the army. The guy that was beaten up by police was a soldier. So those are people that are ready actually to put their life on the line for the country. But when they're back into the society, back in normal life, they are discriminated. The level of poverty is more than double the average within the society, among children even higher. Attainment in school, much lower than among the general population. So this kind of develops this type of bitterness and anger that show the manifestation and demonstration.
And when you talk about, you know, problems in schools and this sort of, you know, really endemic problems, it sort of begs the question, well, what is being done? Is any sort of government address being sought? I mean, we've seen Netanyahu sort of stepping into this debate in the last sort of 24 hours, but pre-election, politicians are often accused of fueling these sorts of problems, that this sort of anger and frustration.
In the case of the Ethiopian, it's just neglect mixed with racism. And that's the end result of it. And of course, when it's all out in the open, Netanyahu makes this kind of gesture that Netanyahu usually do, but without addressing the real issue. Is he going actually to put the budgets, the programs, the plan in order to integrate Ethiopian Jews in the Israeli society in the way that they will feel Israelis? Some of these young guys were born in Israel. They're not even immigrants. Only 32% of the Ethiopians originally came from Ethiopia. Most of them are now were born in Israel. So are they going to feel an equal citizen? And is Israel going to be treated as equal citizen? And is the bigger picture that you implied earlier of racism in Israel going to be addressed at all? Because it's also other minorities in Israel, also the Arab minority, that is treated badly.
Just looking back at their history, though, some appalling things have been done. Forced sterilization of Ethiopian women. You've got the rejection of their blood because it was thought to be tainted by HIV. You've got those things. And then if you look a little bit more recently, of course, the Netanyahu talking about Arabs coming out in their droves, as you say, not only against Ethiopians, but those racist remarks. So one could take it from that the government might themselves be responsible for this.
The government is responsible for everything that happens within a country, and they should take responsibility for this. But not only this government, is for the last 30 years, governments didn't address this issue of racism, embedded racism within Israel properly. It was swept under the carpet instead of dealing with integration. And as you mentioned about the kind of refusing to take blood donation, it can be checked and tested before it's used if there is any case of HIV/AIDS. Instead of that, they insulted, they humiliated the community time after time, their religiousness, their Jewishness, every aspect of their life that they take pride. And as a result of it, you have a disenchanted community within Israel. This is a very peaceful community. Many, many, many years ago, I had students in my class back in Tel Aviv from the Ethiopian community, and I can tell you, you won't find friendlier people and more peaceful people than the Ethiopian Jews.
That was Yossi Meckelberg, Associate Fellow in the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House, in a highlight from the Monocle Daily. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24 with me, Matt Alagaya. This week, the Ukrainian Prime Minister began a campaign to rid his country of communism. Soviet, it's been reported, has become a byword for spying. Last month, three laws were passed outlawing Nazi and communist symbols. In the meantime, the murders of two prominent Ukrainians in Kiev last month have led to accusations that Moscow is trying to destabilize the country from within. In this highlight from The Globalist, Emma Nelson was joined by Maxim Eristavi, an independent journalist based in Kiev, who had more on this story.
These laws were envisioned as a powerful manifesto to confront the Ukrainian troubled history. And obviously, one of the part of this legislation, for example, is very smart and very wise, is open up Soviet archives. But there are other provisions, like, for example, banning public display of Soviet and Nazi symbols, or confronting or even battling the discussion about the true nature of Soviet regimes, as the law says. which is considered as too harsh and poorly written, and it avoids a lot of nuances of really complicated Ukrainian history. And for example, just for publicly displaying Soviet symbols, you can get up to 5 years in jail, which is extremely harsh. For example, if you compare with Germany, similar law banning display of Nazi symbols is just, you can get just 2 years in prison. So it's really heavily criticized by scholars, by human rights defenders, and by regular Ukrainians, some regular Ukrainians too.
It sounds, in your opinion, as if it is an ill-thought-out law. However, it is something that sends a very, very clear message to Moscow.
It's true. And I spoke to the authors of this legislation, and the main driven force behind this legislation is obviously to try to prevent Russia from, how they call it, hijacking the Ukrainian history, because Russia uses this as a powerful tool right now in campaign against Ukraine, saying, for example, as President Putin said on many occasions, that Ukraine is just a part of Russia and we have similar history, and there is no point for Ukraine to deny it or trying to break free from Russia. But at the same time, it's also not just a powerful message for Russia, but it could be also a powerful election tool, because Ukraine is facing 6 months of very important local elections. And suddenly you have this very powerful tool to talk to voters. Instead of talking about lack of reforms or slow progress with reforming, everybody will fight about renaming streets and cities and about the very divisive issue of troubled history.
Finally, Maxim, tell us about the murders or the repercussions of the murders of Oleg Kalashnikov and Oles Buzina, who are anti-government campaigners but who were murdered last week, and there is talk that it was Moscow who was behind these deaths to try to make the government look bad.
Obviously, the investigation is still ongoing, so there is no ground for right now for any conclusive thoughts on that, or any speculation are not very welcome. But at the same time, you know, it's a part of a rising problem in Ukraine, the uncontrolled divisive rhetoric used by politicians. So there is no room for any reconciliation or any talks about accepting the truth or finding common ground. And it's a trend all around the region, this search for external enemy narrative, and it's becoming more popular among politicians. But in Ukraine and Russia, it's been abused the most, and people are talking just in really radicalized terms, especially politicians, about just fighting the external and internal enemy. And this is a part of problem for the societies, for very radicalized society.
That was a highlight from Tuesday's Globalist. It's time now for a highlight from Wednesday's edition of The Briefing. The Finnish military has been sending letters to some 900,000 reservists in an effort to improve communication with its huge reserve army in the face of an increasing threat from its neighbour Russia. So is Finland's reserve army a force to be reckoned with? Well, Monocle's resident Finn, and a trained Finnish soldier himself, Marcus Hippi, joined Andrew Tuck in the studio to offer his insights into the matter.
I haven't received the letter. I've been wondering if I'm going to receive it or not. Supposedly, they may not send the letters to all the reservists in case they are living abroad. So I'm afraid I may not get mine. But I do know, I do have an idea of what I would do if something was to happen. I've actually signed myself to do communications for the Finnish military. I actually gave them a call a few years ago just to let them know that I've actually been doing a lot more since the times when I got my basic training, and they were grateful for that information. So if I just recap what's going on now, Finnish military has announced they're sending 900,000 letters to Finnish reservists, and everyone seems to be thinking that that has got something to do with the threat of Russia. But Finnish military is denying the claim, saying that they've been planning this for a couple of years already. Supposedly, it's about spending cuts. Finnish military doesn't have as much money as they used to have before, and therefore they want to make the system more efficient. They want to increase the communication with people who've got the training, and they want to gather some information as well. So supposedly, when you receive this letter, I haven't seen a copy of that yet, they're going to ask what you have done since the days when you got your basic training, what kind of education you've got, what kind of work experience you've got.
But as a PR exercise, it's very successful, because this number 900,000, I presume that the Finnish government hopes it will give pause for thought to anybody who is attempting to or considering crossing the border potentially one day. They think, okay, there is potentially a million soldiers almost that we would have to face up to.
I think the Finnish military is indeed a force to be reckoned with. And I think this is incredibly clever. I didn't even realize that myself until someone mentioned that yesterday, pointed out in the Finnish press, that actually the world is realizing what Finland has, how many men soldiers there are who are willing to go and fight for their country. At the same time, it is also interesting to see that the Finnish military is so eager to deny the issue with Russia. The Newsweek paper magazine announced that created a clear connection between the Russian threat and these letters, and it took a matter of minutes, and they were already saying that that's not the case.
Well, Finland's always had a kind of uneasy relationship with Russia. You know, there's been the odd war or two in the past, and a border change here and there, which not everybody was happy about on the Finnish side. But on the whole, there's been a kind of an easy, uneasy kind of relationship.
Deep down, everyone knows that Russia can be a threat. However, Finland doesn't want to admit that, because acknowledging the problem is actually creating the problem at the same time, potentially.
Now tell me, as a reservist, do you get called up already for going back to, you said you let them know what you're up to, and you could certainly be run radio communications maybe, but do you get called to go back on training? Do you have a gun back in your apartment in Helsinki?
I feel rather unwanted. It seems that I haven't gone through the type of training they appreciate the most. I know many, many people who go and get retrained almost a yearly basis, and they are those soldiers who are actually fighting, and they get training in the use of weapons and whatever they do. When I'm on the communications sector, I may get a call in a few years, but so far I haven't been trained.
But when you signed up to the army, how long does the average Finn spend in the army?
It changed since my times. When I was there, the minimum was 9 months. I did a year. And nowadays, it spans between 6 months and 13 months, depending on how demanding the work is you've got to do.
And when you were that 1 year in the army, what did they train you to do?
The first 3-4 months was the basic training that everyone goes through, basic fighting skills. It sounds quite rough, but I was actually taught how to kill, literally. I was told how to use a knife. I was also told how to shoot. I was trained in basic fighting in forest conditions. I was camping outside in minus 20 degrees for a week. And we just did a lot of exercise.
That was Monocle's Marcus Hippie speaking to our editor, Andrew Tuck. Up next, a highlight from our series this week as we head to Haiti, plus a snippet from our Friday coverage of the UK elections.
Global affairs, culture, business, design, or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows hosted here on Monocle 24. I'm Matt Alagaya. It's now time for a highlight from our weekly series, which is all about rebuilding. From natural disasters to war zones, we've looked at what happens once the dust settles. We've looked at the destruction a natural disaster can cause in Indonesia, how women helped clear the rubble in post-war Germany, and the protection of cultural heritage in 1966 Florence. But what happens when there's a need to restore a sentiment? In 2010, after the earthquake devastated much of Haiti, including its capital, Port-au-Prince, rebuilding the iconic central market of the city, the Iron Market, became top priority. The reason was simple. Its restoration represented the resilience of its people, as well as the country's physical recovery. This reconstruction project was led by London-based architecture practice John McCaslin and Partners. And on Thursday's edition of The 10, we heard from Monocle's producer, David Pleasant, who sat down with the executive chairman and founder, John McCaslin, to chat about the importance of recovering such an important civic landmark.
I had been going to Haiti for a number of years prior to the earthquake in 2010, and principally I began going through the Clinton Foundation because they have a particular interest, or had an interest and continue to have an interest, in developing a community and educational and other projects in Haiti. So I was there sort of helping them. And then, of course, the terrible earthquake occurred in January of 2010. And we were, I suppose, fortunate enough, if that's the right expression, to be commissioned for the restoration, repair and rebuild of one of the key buildings in Port-au-Prince.
That building, the Iron Market in Port-au-Prince, can you kind of describe that sort of consensus around that particular building and the kind of need to get it rebuilt?
The Iron Market has always been a key building in Port-au-Prince and a much loved building. It was a market hall that had been built in 1891, employed thousands of people, either directly or indirectly, and was the centre of trading and market life in the capital. In a way, one of the key things that allowed us to move fairly quickly was the fact that we had a sponsor for the project, a guy called Dennis O'Brien, who is one of the leading employers in Haiti. He runs a company called Digicel, communications company, and he was a kind of classic patron philanthropist who immediately stepped forward and committed to funding the project. So in a way, having the funds in place to do the project dealt with one of the main hurdles, that is getting funding. I suppose the other key problem associated was actually just finding the materials to rebuild it, and we took all sorts of shortcuts to make that happen. We got a steel manufacturer from the States to produce the steel and to get it shipped and ease its way through the kind of port system to get that on site. And we also employed about 750 local artisans who were obviously desperately looking for work to do a lot of the repair work and indeed a lot of the decorative metal work. So there were people looking for work. There was a funder in place with Dennis O'Brien, and I think a team of people, you know, led by ourselves, I guess, who were committed to seeing this building restored within 1 year of the earthquake.
If we kind of jump forward a little bit and look at what's just happened in Nepal, the kind of terrible loss or damage to heritage buildings there, do you think there's any sort of comparisons that can be made, for instance?
You know, it's obviously tragic but timely to compare Haiti and Nepal. You know, there are various stages in an earthquake, and the first, of course, is to save as many lives as you possibly can, and the second is then to stabilise what's left. And the third is to obviously rehouse and try to get the country back in some sort of functioning way. If there is then a rebuilding effort that requires architects who have skills or who are able to support that endeavour, then of course I think that's the appropriate time to step forward. I mean, in a way in Haiti, we were there quickly because we were already very familiar with the country and we were very familiar with that building. And we had a client who really wanted to move things very quickly and to use the Iron Market as a sort of symbol of hope, you know, in what is one of the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere.
That kind of dichotomy between housing people, you've stated very clearly the importance of doing that over perhaps looking at very important buildings within a city or a culture. How do you justify that, basically? How do you kind of look at a building like the Market Building and sort of value its importance to a community? I mean, if there is the problem of housing and so on, what kinds of arguments can you put forward as an architect? I mean, is it a challenge or do you think it's patently obvious?
That's a very good question. It's where do you decide to make a contribution? If you look at the simple facts in Haiti, the earthquake caused about $10 billion of damage. So that's a huge project, so the cost of building Terminal 5 or something. And whilst rehousing and new schools and new hospitals are, of course, incredibly important and more important than rebuilding the Iron Market, for a moment I wouldn't argue with that. I think in terms of pure straightforwardness of a project that would be symbolic and that we knew would be finished because it was fully funded and didn't require complex issues of land tenure or international funding. In a way, it was a project that one could have done in here or in Dublin or anywhere else. It was a very simple piece of reconstruction in relative terms. The only complexity was that the ownership of the land was the city's, but they authorised the restoration and that the heritage groups there authorised the restoration. So I think it was, from purely kind of pragmatic point of view and a sort of symbolic representation of hope for the future, the Iron Market was a great success and achieved everything we could have hoped it could have achieved. But in relative terms, I absolutely agree that, you know, to have rehoused people in permanent safe housing is a more important, more significant and more challenging project, which remains indeed extremely challenging in Haiti and as it has in other post-earthquake areas.
That was Monocle's David Pleasant speaking to architect John McCaslin in this highlight from The 10. You're listening to The Recap here on Monocle 24. It's almost time to head off, but before we do, it's time for a highlight from Friday's edition of The Globalist. Thursday's election in the UK was hailed as the most exciting and hardest to call in a generation. Georgina Godwin was joined by Paul Osborne for this election discussion, and in a moment we'll hear from Downing Street. But first, let's look back at the weeks of anticipation ahead of Thursday's vote, as we covered it on Monocle 24.
I think that the two main parties, blue and red teams, are still completely deadlocked, and you will just get more of this sort of trench warfare attrition.
There is no way any sensible Labour leader, if they were Prime Minister, would have a referendum, because they would probably lose. No politician, apart from Nigel Farage in Britain, wants to be the politician who's taken Britain out of Europe.
A lot of people expect the Conservatives to come out on top in terms of number of votes, maybe number of seats as well. That doesn't necessarily mean that David Cameron will end up as Prime Minister, because there are a lot more anti-Conservative parties likely to be in the next Parliament than pro.
The main international angle will be what will happen with the European Union. But the European topic hasn't been very discussed so far.
25 years ago, the Tory party went into a complete meltdown over Europe, and they haven't recovered since. They've dragged the British people along with them into this stance which Sean rather wittily describes as, you know, indifferent.
Everything's gone mad. This has been the most bizarre election I can remember, I'd say, and that's just the latest one of those, frankly.
Well, those are just some of the voices we've welcomed to Midori House here in recent weeks, including the journalist and regular Monocle 24 commentator, Paul Osborne. Paul's with me in the studio after a busy day and night covering yesterday's vote. Paul, I know you're very tired. An election like no other, though.
Absolutely extraordinary. And what you heard in that montage there was pretty much every political commentator in Britain would tell you the same story up until 10 p.m. London time last night, which was that this was the closest, tightest general election campaign in at least 40 years. We did not know what was going to happen. We didn't think that there was much space between the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, and that the likelihood was that even if the Conservative Party won the most seats, that the Labour Party could actually end up in government. What's happened? The Conservative Party may well just manage an outright win. The Liberal Democrats, who are their coalition partners, have come close to being wiped out. The Labour Party, who we thought may well be with a chance of governing, have lost ground and have had, by their own leader's admission, a very bad night. And in Scotland, the result's been completely different. The Scottish National Party has won pretty much every single seat in Scotland.
Well, we're going to analyse all of that a little bit later on. Just first, though, tell me, what was your favourite moment of election night?
My favourite moment of election night, I mean, it's a little bit personal, this. I started my radio career in a local radio station in Wales. It was a sort of pop music station. And one of the things we used to do was go out to nightclubs and do sort of nightclub gigs where we'd stand on the stage and do stupid games and all this kind of nonsense. And one of the people I did that with, still a very good friend of mine, was at her wedding several years ago. And I watched her about 4 hours ago be elected as the Conservative MP for the southern English town of Eastleigh. By her own admission, when she was selected as the candidate, she said, "I don't think that's very likely to happen." And then at about 4 o'clock this morning, I sent her a message in capital letters going, "You appear to be a member of parliament now."
That was a highlight from Friday's edition of The Globalist. Well, that's all we've got time for on this week's edition of The Recap. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and edited by Nina Norick. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programmes here on Monocle 24. But for now, from me, Matt Alagaya, thank you for listening. Goodbye.